From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Eric Boghossian, author, playwright, and actor, is my guest. His plays include Talk Radio, Suburbia, and as an actor, he appeared on stage in movies and on television, including a few seasons on Law & Order Criminal Intent. He's just published Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian Genocide. Eric Boghossian, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thanks, Gary.
So when you write a play or a novel, you can just make it all up. But Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian Genocide, that required, you know, extensive research. Was it more difficult to write this than other things?
Well, there definitely is an aspect of writing and researching history in which, I mean, basically when I'm writing fiction or I'm writing a play and I get jammed, I just make, my job is to make the next thing up. I had never written history before, so occasionally I would get to a spot where I would sort of imagine what happened. But when I worked with the scholars and the editors, finishing as the book was in its last year or so, and they would say, "What's this here? Where did you get this from?" And I'd say, "Well, I figured that sort of must have happened." And they go, "No, no, we need a source for everything." Wow. So there are like 250 endnotes. It was fun. I mean, in many ways, it was a detective story where I knew the bare bones of the story, which was that there was this conspiracy operating out of Massachusetts to go into Europe and gun down all these Turkish leaders, one that no one had really talked about. There was this obscure book out of France about it, but generally people just didn't know this story. I mean, if you're going to talk about the Armenian Genocide, which was talked about a lot this year, I think it's pretty important to mention that 5 years after the Armenian Genocide, a group of Armenians decided to assassinate most of the men who were responsible for that genocide and succeeded in doing that, from New England to Berlin, Rome, Constantinople, Tbilisi. So at any rate, there was plenty to try to figure out, and I went into archives, and I, British archives, and into old newspapers in Rome and in Germany and so forth. I went to places, I interviewed as many people as I could. I read about 500 books, I sourced about 1,000 books, and the outline became much clearer, and I was able to also search out some things I had suspected, which was that British intelligence had aided and abetted this conspiracy, which was actually a significant point. So like I say, it was a real new experience for me, the whole process, all the way down the line.
Well, was writing this book something that you've had in your mind to do for a long time and you finally got to it, or was it, how did it happen that you decided to tell the story now?
No, what happened was, if I had known that it was going to be such a large project, I mean, this is actually, I spent more time on this project than I have on anything else I've ever worked on, and that includes Talk Radio, which was a very long-term, writing the play and then the play becoming a movie. There was a lot that went into that, but this was about 7 years. What had happened was, as an Armenian American and as somebody who was, I guess, a notable writer, Armenians had asked me, they come to my shows or whatever, and say, "When are you going to write something about the genocide?" I just couldn't, the genocide, about Armenian experience. I was like, I don't know what to write about. And then I heard this story about this assassination of Talat Pasha in Berlin in 1921. But what I heard was what had been said in court, which was this engineering student who had survived the genocide, survived a massacre in which he'd seen his whole family murdered, ended up in Berlin 5 years after the war and recognized Talat, who was the leader of the Ottoman Empire pretty much during World War One. I say pretty much, there were other leaders. He saw him, he recognized him. He said that his mother came to in a dream, and his dead mother, and said, "How can you let this man live?" And he got a hold of a pistol and he shot him and he killed him. And then there was a court case. And in Berlin, they felt that if you see your whole family massacred, then you have a right to kill the man responsible. Like if somebody who had survived the Holocaust saw Hitler, I mean, you can imagine that, that you could forgive them for killing Hitler. Well, this was the same thing for the son. I heard this story and I thought I would write a movie about it. It seemed to lend itself to a movie very easily. I would write about what it was like to be in one of these deportation caravans, this young man surviving, this young man in Berlin shooting Talat, and then ending with the trial. The only problem was, is as I began to research it, I discovered that everything he said at the trial was a fabrication. He wasn't an engineering student. He hadn't seen his family killed. He wasn't just some guy who just happened upon Talat Pasha in Berlin. Rather, he was a trained assassin who was stalking Talat and with a whole group of people. And of course, it was a planned assassination. And even his being caught was planned because they wanted there to be this trial so that in the trial they could talk, or he could talk about the genocide. And not only was it just this assassination, but there were five other significant assassinations that occurred all over Europe around the same time, 1921, 1922. So when I heard that story, I thought, well, this is so much more complicated than what I can do in a movie. And I kind of plunked myself down and started. I figured I'm good friends with a very popular historian named Sarah Vowell.
Oh, sure.
And, and Sarah's work is just fantastic, and she finds a way to really make accessible some difficult historical stuff. So I thought, I'll do this. I'll try to figure out a way to make it accessible. But it was a very complex topic, and it required a lot of research into things I didn't know anything about, like not just like who are the Armenians or what is Armenia, or but also what was the Ottoman Empire, which I knew nothing about. I knew no World War I history, particularly of this region. I just didn't know. I didn't know much about the Russian Revolution, which sort of is important here as well. So my job was to, first of all, learn as much as I could about Operation Nemesis and all the figures in it, which included the conspirators and the gunmen and the spies and all this intercontinental stuff that they did. Learn all of that, set it in a context, and then make sure everything's factual, and then make it so that you can, you know, some layperson, somebody who is not, you know, doesn't really, isn't familiar with any of this,
somebody
can read
like
it
me.
And read it with interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, you know, I wanted to be like a really interesting magazine article or something. Like, oh, I never, I mean, if you're Armenian, this stuff is, if you're Armenian extraction, then this is, I guess, sort of automatically interesting. But I think that this story really transcends anything having to do with Armenian. I mean, this is an amazing story just in terms of history. This is a group of small-time businessmen in the New England, New York area who make this decision to put this together and succeed at it. There's a CPA, a life insurance salesman, an editor of a small newspaper, and they put it together and they pull it off, and they basically change world history. But it took a lot longer than I thought it would. And it was one of these situations sort of like, I don't know, where you think, oh, it would be fun to climb that mountain, and then halfway up you're like,
what was I thinking?
Very difficult, but you're halfway there, yeah. So you might as well keep going and finish. And like I say, I mean, just in terms of my life, in terms of enlarging my sense of who I am, because this has very much to do with my grandparents and where they come from, but also to be working on something in your 50s that's completely different than anything you've ever done before, I think is a gift, and was a gift to myself, honestly. And I wish it on anybody who's been sort of trudging along one path their whole life, and then you say, okay, I'm going to do something really different. And it worked out. My publisher is great. Little Brown was great. The editors, all the my fellow scholars and researchers who helped me out with this, sort of the pieces came together. It's a situation where you're not always happy with every project you worked on. Like I've written a zillion plays, a zillion screenplays, and most of them never see the light of day. But this thing kind of pieced together. There were some really fun parts of this too, like having the maps made for the book or finding photos and, you know, doing the photo research and that stuff. That, you know, I'll never have anybody make maps for me again. I'm sure of that.
Unless you make the movie, the Operation Nemesis movie.
Yeah, then we'll have to have maps for that. We'll do it like they used to do in the old 1940s.
Like in Casablanca,
superposed. Yeah, in the action, and you see the arrow crossing. Well, you kind of need that in order to understand this, because I honestly, I didn't really know where my grandparents came from. I didn't really understand that part of the world. And usually when they talk about World War One, they talk of, I grew up with like the whole thing about trench warfare and France versus Germany and the doughboys and all that junk. But this is all happening down in the former Ottoman Empire, down into what, you know, we call the Middle East. And this is when all that was established. From that point on, from the end of World War One, this is the Middle East that we live with today. And all these countries, Saudi Arabia, Syria, even the outlines of contemporary Turkey, all of this was set at this exact moment. In fact, the day after Talat was assassinated, March 16th, 1921, is the day that the country of Iraq was established. And that's, I don't even know what to do with that fact, because I really believe that a lot of what was happening at the end of the war did have to do with oil, particularly regarding the British. They wanted Mesopotamia, they got it. We call it Iraq today. And these regions where the Kurds live are also, when you're in the Turkish areas, are where the Armenians lived for thousands of years. And, well, in Turkey, anyway, they don't live there anymore because the whole region was ethnically cleansed of Armenians and Greeks and other Christians. But over a million Armenians died during the genocide.
So that's kind of interesting, because you're saying, first of all, you mentioned Sarah Vowell, and her histories are really interesting, but they're also kind of funny. And your book, it was hard to say that I enjoyed Operation Nemesis, because enjoy is like the wrong word. But if you love to learn, and I do, then you know, the desire to learn from a great professor like Eric Bogosian, you'd find this book a fulfilling experience, which I did. But you've got this book, I mean, the cover of the book is splattered with blood, and there are millions of people who die in the book. And at the same time, it's a book in which millions of people die, and yet there's an assassination. It's interesting to think about how one death can be a compelling story in the face of so much death.
Yeah, I mean, definitely when I soon realized that I would not be able to take the light touch that Sarah brings to much of what she talks about. I mean, Sarah's books, and I've read them all, cover the Pilgrims, the assassination of Lincoln and the other presidents, the history of Hawaii. These stories, you can kind of put an angle on. You can't really, first of all, it's very recent, it's very personal, and genocide is essentially a concept that you can't actually hold in your mind because it's too much. It's just inconceivable how people could do this to one another. And as I got deeper into research, I had heard horror stories from my grandfather, but I had no idea really the extent and the intensity of the violence. And so I had to make sure that was clear from the beginning of the book, that that's what these men are responding to. Because if you don't understand that the men that put Operation Nemesis in action had lost every town, every village, every city where they knew anybody or had any friends or family or anybody, everyone was gone, all wiped out. And so some Armenians after this period focused on, let's say, collecting up the orphans. There were thousands of orphans, finding them, making sure they were taken care of, finding women who had been forced into Muslim homes or become prostitutes, or fighting a war, or helping with people who were starving. In this particular group of men, they felt that there had to be an eye for an eye. There had to be something that was done that was very clear, and they were going to go after these men who they felt and who had been proven to be, because there were juries in at the end of the war, there were trials at the end of the war in Istanbul. These men were war criminals, and they had escaped punishment by going abroad, and they were hiding out. And so the Operation Nemesis felt that, because that's what Nemesis means, retribution, that they would go and find wherever these men were and execute justice as it had been prescribed in the trials in Istanbul or Constantinople. So it's a decision. Anyway, it's very serious, obviously. It's not an easy period to talk about. It's not an easy thing. But there's a lot of I learned so much while I was putting it together. I had to stick as much of that into the book as possible. For example, the history of the Ottoman Empire, which I knew nothing about.
It's not a furniture store, I found out.
No. Although it probably been, you know, there's all these words and things that come from there, and probably Ottoman has something to do with Ottoman Empire. But, you know, the period of the Sultans is a fantastic story, the harem. And so many of these stories have been exaggerated and transformed into almost a cartoon kind of notions. If you ask the average person what's a harem or what's a sultan, I mean, what comes to mind is, you know, a Disney cartoon or something. It's right. Not going to be what was actually there. And it's significant. I mean, I think to some degree, and there are Armenians, I'm sure, who would be unhappy that I say this, but I think that if you put the genocide aside and the violence against the minorities aside, the Ottoman Empire as an empire has gotten short shrift in history books, because it was a major empire and it was significant, and it is worth knowing about. And certainly if you're Armenian, it's worth knowing about, because the Armenians were integral to this empire for hundreds and hundreds of years until they decided they didn't need them anymore and they want to kill them all. You know, if you go to visit Istanbul today and you go as a tourist, as you enter the great harbor there on the hill, you will see the great, great mosques. In fact, the greatest of all is at the top of the hill, the Mosque of Suleiman, the Magnificent. And these mosques are very, very impressive, and they constitute basically what makes Istanbul so beautiful. It's one of the major components of it. Well, all of those mosques were designed by an Armenian. And that's something that, you know, it's something we will never be able to totally divide the Armenians from Turkish history. We're not just the genocide. We were very important contributors to the culture of that country for centuries. So that's all stuff I didn't, believe me, I knew none of this when I started working on all of this. I knew that there was a place called Turkey and that a lot of Armenians had died, including two of my great-grandfathers. But beyond that, I didn't really know the story. And I think that if you have, I'm inquisitive, curious, and I just let my curiosity lead me, and then I try to reflect on that with the stories that I tell in the book.
We're talking with Eric Boghossian, and his book is called Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. And really, it's an act of terrorism. That is, Operation Nemesis were terrorists. I mean, it's interesting with terrorism, if you believe they're doing the right thing, then they're not terrorists. But wouldn't you say that every terrorist group believes strongly that they are doing the right thing?
Well, there's what has happened with the term terror, and I'm going to have to argue with you a little bit about this, because I've had people argue with me about it.
Good.
It's transformed over the period of time. What you have in the 19th century, when this group and other groups, including groups in Russia, who ended up overthrowing the Tsar, all the different communist groups there. These guys employed a form of terror in which they would go after the targets, like they saw themselves at war with whoever the leaders were, the oppressors, anybody they saw as a traitor to their cause, somebody who was part of their world but had, you know, been a spy or done something against the group, or a symbol like a bank or something where they would blow the bank up or do something. They tended to not want to and did not believe in hurting anybody who wasn't part of the game. So they didn't go after innocents. They didn't blow up, you know, just randomly places.
Right.
And they stayed away from sort of civilians or children or, you know, just blowing up every day some market in Iraq gets blown up. And that is a different kind of terror. That's a destabilizing terror. Whereas this was more like a kind of a warfare thing. At first against the Sultan, and then primarily against the Sultan, Abdul Hamid. Things like cutting telegraph wires. But they stayed away from going after people they saw who were not participants in this back and forth struggle. Now, of course, nothing is perfect, and we know all about collateral damage in war, so I'm not going to argue for war. I'm not going to argue for violence. The reason I focused on these men in this story is because in the center of it is a kernel of moral and ethical dilemma, which is that certainly Talat and let's say Dr. Shakir and Enver Pasha and Jamal Pasha were responsible for hundreds of thousands of people, we're talking civilians here, not soldiers, dying, and as such were war criminals and had been proven such. So what do you do with that when you need, I mean, especially in the case of some of these men who had lost, I mean, when I say that Tetlarion was fabricating things in court, his mother had died, his sister-in-law's had died, he just wasn't there, he hadn't seen it. But he had this very heavy weight on him, as did many people who survived, of what do we do now? And I find this to be a problem that I have to really ponder and wonder, what would I do in this instance? Could I do this? But I have to do this, because I think that's basically what happened with these men. They had to do it. They were compelled. So there's all of that that has to go into the mix as well. I don't know that they were doing it because they were trying to terrorize either. They felt, I believe, strongly that when the war finally, the war was sort of hanging in there. Even though the war was over at this point, there were still insurgencies that were being led by Turks in Anatolia, and the British and the French were finally just getting tired of it, and they gave up. And that's the famous story of Smyrna, when Kemal came in with his troops, and there were a huge number of deaths in Smyrna in 1922. So they felt, the Nemesis guys felt, that if they didn't knock these guys off, soon they would be back in power, and they would resume killing Armenians. And they, if there was anybody left, they were going to kill them, because clearly they had targeted Armenians for total eradication. So they believed they were stopping something, and they were. They did stop these men from returning to power. They didn't kill Enver Pasha, who was the third member of the triumvirate, but the Soviets ended up killing him in 1920s, also 22 or 23. So, weirdly, by removing all these players from the Turkish scene, it left one man standing, and that man was Mustafa Kemal, later to be known as Ataturk. And I don't think there was any love lost between Kemal and some of these guys, between him and Talat, or between him and Enver. So, weirdly, Kemal got what he wanted. He got to get rid of all of his enemies, and he ended up being the leader, and he established the Republic of Turkey in 1923. Some of this stuff's kind of complicated, and it's hard to give it all in a nutshell on a phone call, which sure. is why I really felt that I needed write the book, so a person could kind of sit with it and ponder it. I try to make the big shapes out there so you can get the picture of, you know, what's going on, but it is significant. In the latter part of the book, I talk about sort of the legacy of all of this, and that takes us up to almost the present. And the Turkish, what is the Turkish government today becomes more and more important to us every day as they become more involved in the Middle East in ways that we hadn't been able to predict, you know, as far as ISIS and the war in Syria and all of that. And I think that anybody reading this book comes away with a better understanding of what modern Turkey is, because it's a complex country. No one should ever think that the Turks are not very, very smart and aren't really, you know, thinking through what they're doing here. I'm not saying they're right in what they're doing. I think Erdogan has been doing some very strange things lately, but this is a part of the world that isn't just about the Middle East. It's also about Russia being looming right over the area. That's always been a big dynamic, and we're seeing it play out right now as Russian fighters are going in, planes are going in, they're crossing Turkish airspace. It's a very, very dynamic and volatile area, and this is the legacy of the end of the Ottoman Empire and the introduction of the British and American interests into the Middle East, all focusing on oil, by the way. If there were no oil there, believe me, nobody would care less about what's going on there. And that was the case all the way back to World War One. There's a sort of a myth that World War One, they really weren't thinking about oil yet, that oil hadn't become strategic, but that's completely untrue. The powers that be were very well aware of what oil would mean in the coming decades, and they knew that whoever could get their hands on the oil would be the most powerful, and that is what has happened. I mean, Britain and the United States and France walked down the oil there, and no one's been able to get to Baku. That's always been, remained in Russian hands, and we can go on and on with this stuff, but if you want to know what's going on there today, I think it's essential to know about the Ottoman Empire, because otherwise you have no idea what you're... When you look at a map, you don't even know what you're looking at.
Right.
All these different countries with all their little boundaries and everything is all something that was all put together right around 1921.
Right. They love to say that the problems of the Middle East are thousands of years old, when really they're less than 100 years old.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up some of the other issues, too, of like, you know, the Armenians were Christian and the Turks were Muslim. And so it's easy to believe that this is some kind of, you know, age-old Christian, Muslim antipathy that's always the case. That's so not necessary. The Ottoman Empire lasted a very long time with Christians amalgamated into their structure, as were Jews. And it doesn't mean that they all want to kill each other. They were certified second-class citizens in a Muslim country. The Armenians, the Greeks, the Jews were all there in this millet system. But it didn't mean that every day that they got up in the morning, the Muslims thought that we want to kill all the Armenians. And likewise, the things that are going on between the different Muslim sects, all of this is, it's part of it. Obviously, it's a way to signify one group versus another group. But I really blame the leaders, because the leaders benefit. They set their people against each other, vast amount of bloodshed, horrible human suffering, and it's because people want power, and they don't really care how they get it. They don't care who suffers because of it. And areas where the economy is barely getting by, this is how things play out. But so that's something worth at least looking at, is what is going on here. Did the Turks kill all the Armenians simply because they were Christian? No, there were other reasons. Armenians had a great deal of power in the Ottoman Empire. They were wealthy in some cases, and this wealth, as one historian says, this is including what happened to the Jews, which I'm not sure if this is true or not, but it's basically, one historian has said that this is the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the world, from the Armenians and Greeks to the Muslim Turks during World War One, because they took all the land, they took all the property, and that land is very valuable, and it all went over to Muslim ownership. Factories, mines, all these things were, and the Ottoman Empire was vast, it was big, and all this wealth went over to them. I wouldn't stand by that quote, I'm just saying that a historian, a noted historian, did say that.
So, in other words, the leaders saw a way to take all this from Armenians by saying, "Hey, they're all Armenians. What if we make everybody hate Armenians, turn them into criminals, so that we can kill them all?" In the same way that the Nazis criminalized the Jews in order to...
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I have a certain experience with law enforcement, having done 60 episodes of Law and Order.
Yeah.
And when you have a murder mystery, you have to find out who benefits, you know, who came out ahead because of this murder. And this is the murder of over a million people. Who came out ahead? Well, the Turks came out ahead because they took all this stuff and they used it as the foundation of the of the new Republic of Turkey. All this land, all these factories, all this gold, all of this became theirs. And they took it and they established a new regime that was Turkish. That's the whole point, is that it's a Turkification of what was a multi-ethnic, multi-religious society up until that time. It's one of the really, really sad things about the Middle East over the last few decades is this ongoing homogenization of the Middle East, where you have areas that used to be multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and they are now one religion, and in most cases Muslim, but of course there's also the cases where it's all Jewish or whatever, and you lose these beautiful cities and places where all the different religions and types of people mingled and merged, whether it was Constantinople or Smyrna or even Jerusalem today. I mean, it's all changing, and it's sad, because if you've ever been to one of these places, it's kind of exciting to go from one neighborhood to the other, and all the different kinds of people who work together and have markets and live in peace. You know, it doesn't have to be this way, but this is where we're going. Places like Salonika are history now. Smyrna is history. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough. I haven't visited all these places, but I guess this is history. This is the march of history. But, you know, funnily, I live in New York City, which is now probably the greatest multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious city in the world. And it's exciting to be in a place like that with all different kinds of people. You know, nobody's killing anybody in New York because of, for religious reasons, as far as I can tell.
They're killing each other, but not for that reason.
We're what?
They're killing each other, just not for that reason.
Right, yeah, like any big city, but I mean, we have lots and lots of Muslims and Hindus and Christians and Jews all living together. It's, you know, I'm kind of a peacenik, so it's kind of strange that I ended up writing so much about violence with this book, but I'm going to promote this idea as best as I can, because this is, I think, you know, the more we know, the better we can live in peace. I guess that's it.
The book is called Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. The author, the great Eric Boghossian, thank you so much for spending some time talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Eric Boghossian. His latest book is called Nemesis, the Assassination Plot that Avenged the Armenian Genocide. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.